This is Brian Ellison of KCUR and the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast with Rocky Suppinger.
Hey, I'm Rocky Suppinger, and this is the Yo Rocco podcast, my chance to talk to people about their interesting projects. Thanks for listening. Today's person is Murphy Daly, and her project is The Russian-American School of Tomorrow, a memoir 12 years in the making, self-published, and now for sale on Amazon. You can find the link to buy The Russian-American School of Tomorrow on the Yo Rocco podcast page at yorocco.com. I met Murphy 3 years ago when she and her preschool-age daughter started coming to worship at the church I serve, the Claremont Presbyterian Church in Claremont, California, and I discovered really quickly that Murphy has a story to tell, and she's not waiting for permission from anyone to tell it, a publisher or anybody else. Right away, when we met, we traded blog addresses, and pretty soon I was reading her posts, and she was reading my blog posts on a regular basis and commenting on them, and a really substantive back and forth started to happen online and off. And it's been one of the cool things about my ministry the last few years. And the thing I appreciate most about Murphy is that she will tell it to you straight. She's really practiced at self-reflection and self-critique, and there's not an ounce of guile in her. And that really comes through in her writing in The Russian-American School of Tomorrow, which is her account of a year of her life when she was 18 and moved to Russia with her parents and two brothers to start an accelerated Christian school in the years following the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's a really interesting story. However, I'd only read about 100 pages of The Russian-American School of Tomorrow at the time of this interview, but even though I hadn't finished the book completely, I decided to invite Murphy onto the podcast because I'm just as interested in what drives her to self-publish a story like this as I am in the details of the story itself. No doubt the interview would have been better if I'd actually finished the book, and I will do that, and maybe I'll have Murphy on again after it's done. But as I think you'll find, we had no shortage of things to talk about besides, and she was very generous and very gracious. So as always, I welcome your feedback about the podcast. You can email me at rockycpc@gmail.com, and I promise to respond. So now, Murphy Daly.
This was my story, and it could so easily have been swayed to try to fit some stereotypical narrative.
I'm interested in talking to you about the book that you just published, but also about, and even more so, about the fact that you publish books and you just do that. So,
you're talking about the Russian-American School of Tomorrow, available for sale right now on Amazon? Yes,
that book. Isn't it on some bestseller list or something right now on Amazon?
Amazon's category bestseller list,
That's
yes.
That's terrific. And what category is in it?
I can't possibly remember.
Really?
It's obscure. It doesn't take much to get on a bestseller list, but it sounds exciting.
It doesn't?
The reason I got to number 5 on that particular category is because I had sold 4 copies that day.
Oh.
So it doesn't take much.
Okay.
But it sounds impressive.
How many copies have you sold total?
I didn't check this morning. I've probably sold 30.
Okay. There's one in my household.
There you go. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you have a, like a target?
No. That's a really, okay, so we're talking now about some of the nuts and bolts of self-publishing, and to have a target, I kind of learned to let go of that sort of expectation with the first book I self-published. I hadn't done it before. The first book I self-published is called The Parable of Miriam the Camel Driver, and that was done in 2006, which is really early in the self-publishing or independent publishing phenomenon. It was published by Lulu.com, which is still available, and you can do it that way, but it became, it was superseded by other methods of self-publishing pretty quickly after that. So anyone that knows better doesn't use that platform anymore. But what I learned was, oh my gosh, I've self-published, how exciting, oh my gosh, I have a real book in my hands. And then basically the world didn't care. They're like, well, my friends were like, wow, that's neat. And some of my family bought it. Some of them didn't. And so I'm like, oh, it doesn't magically take over the world and mean that, you know, twittering birds follow me everywhere like Snow White.
As somebody who has thought about writing books and thought, oh, I should write a book. Like, wouldn't it be great if I wrote a book? You have this expectation that once you do that, it like your life is just magically different. You're saying that was not true.
It certainly felt different to me. But the next realization was, oh, I got a lot more work to do. So all of the work of writing the book, which took a certain sort of set of muscles, and then all of the work of making the written manuscript into a published book that you could hold in your hands, that was not only a published book you could hold in your hands, but it was available for sale all over the world, that was another set of muscles. And then there comes the next set of muscles, which is letting people know that they want to buy it. And that could be called promotion or marketing. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other set of muscles. So
with the first book, it was just the first set of muscles, just writing the book.
Well, the first two sets.
Okay. But you weren't promoting it as much.
Interestingly, with the first book, I didn't mean for the first book to be a book.
Okay.
It was a series of articles on my blog that was a fictionalized account of something that had happened in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to write that. And then I wrote it. My husband read it, and he said, you know what? This should be a book. And he had just used Lulu.com to publish a catalog for his business. He published a catalog that people could order his collectible ships. And he's like, well, this catalog publishing place could also write a book very easily. At the time, I don't know what the pricing is now, but at the time it was like about $300 to get a package of global distribution. So that $300 made it available for sale on Amazon, as well as part of the database that was accessible by every bookstore. So you could walk into Barnes and Nobles or what are the other ones anymore? I barely remember.
Yeah, they're all gone.
And you could order it. Yeah, you could order it from there. You could special order it and they could get it for you. So they wouldn't necessarily stock it, but they could order it for anyone that asked for it.
Okay.
So you could get that global distribution package. And he's like, he knew about this because he'd used it. And so we tried that out. And we did all the work to lay it out, choosing the fonts, building the cover, doing all those types of work, making sure that it was laid out properly. And because it wasn't actually that much, it wasn't that long of a text, we carefully used white space and made the margins really wide. Lots of...
And you just did this on like Microsoft Word? Or was there,
yes.
There wasn't a special piece of publishing software that you used?
No, this one was Word.
Okay. So here's what I'm curious about. Like, people aspire to write books, but they and they aspire to be published.
Yes.
But the model for doing that is to get picked by a publisher and like, right, submit a proposal and get published, right? Did you do this self-publishing thing after trying that, or this is just where you started?
You know what's so wonderful? I hear these stories all the time about, how many rejections so-and-so got before this famous book got accepted. And that's the old model. You can do that. People still do that now. And you can create a book. And I found out how to do that. You can create a book proposal. You can do all these things. You can try to get an agent. I found out how to do that. And every time I looked at it, I thought, what a huge waste of time. Not only is it like unnecessarily steps in the way of getting from here to holding the book in your hand, but it's also, well, it's also somebody else getting their paws on my words,
huh,
on my voice that I created. I don't want somebody else saying, well, you know, you really need a different ending.
So you don't want an editor.
I want my words to be, my writing to be the highest possible quality it can be. I think an editor can get in the way of that.
Did you have anybody edit this, the Russian American School of Tomorrow? Or did you just do all the proofing and all the editing yourself?
I paid an editor to give me corrections and to catch errors and to I forget the name of it. There's a copy editor that can check for whether it's spelled right in commas and things like that. And I also paid this woman to do a little more in depth to check and see if it, you know, made sense. And there were a couple spots that weren't right. And far earlier in the process, way early in the process, thank you to all my patient friends, I had been using book groups, writing groups, and foisting it upon anyone that would take it and give me feedback. But the final decision for every single word in this book was mine.
Okay. And that's how you want it.
That's how I wanted it. Because in this case, this was my story. And it could so easily have been swayed to try to fit some stereotypical narrative. And I absolutely did not want that stereotype narrative. I wanted this to be my authentic story. Because it would so easily just be slightly twisted. And then that would kill it. It had to be real. It had to be super real. And super important. I didn't know what this story was going to look like until I got to the end.
Really?
I didn't know what the story was until it was finished. And then I went, oh, that's what this story is.
Even though it's about your life.
Especially because it's about my life.
Okay.
Can you look back at like 2 years in your life and go, oh, that was the basic thrust of those 2 years?
Okay, no. so let's talk about what the book's actually about. So,
yes.
So 2 years in your life, where what happened?
Well, it was what amounts to 1 year in my life. So I grew up, I was born and raised in Alaska. I was with my family part of the Christian school movement. My parents started a lot of Christian schools.
In Alaska?
In Alaska and in California. We had a brief stint in Humboldt County, and then we moved back to Alaska. So they did a lot of Christian school work. And then when I was going into eighth grade, they decided to do the next level of Christian school, which was at that time homeschooling. So they started a homeschooling program with the church that I was part of, and my older brother and I were homeschooled for high school. So I was homeschooled for high school, and then I had the story begins, the Russian-American School of Tomorrow begins as I was leaving home. I had had a year of college at this point. I wanted to get out of the house because I was a teenager and didn't want to be under my parents' thumb anymore. So I had left for the summer, and I was thinking this would be my launching point. Then my parents had this opportunity. One of the types of schools, Christian schools, they had started, Accelerated Christian Education, which was rebranded to be called the School of Tomorrow, was going to start planting Christian schools in Russia.
What year is this?
1991. Okay. Was when we first found out about it.
All right. So the Cold War is over. This is not Gorbachev's Russia.
So when we flew in to Russia, Yeltsin had just come into power.
Okay.
The Soviet Union had just dissolved, and the day that we flew in was the day that the new flag flew,
right.
The tricolor. So the hammer and sickle was starting to disappear, and it did disappear the day we landed.
Right. So this is like a really interesting time to be showing up in Russia.
Very interesting.
To plant Christian schools.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a complicated story. So I could... You should read the book because there's a lot more to it.
Well, I know the first part of it. I haven't finished it.
I'm sorry, Rocky. When I say you, I'm speaking to the audience. You all should read the book. It's fascinating. I know you're in the middle of the book.
I am.
And you are in the middle of dozens of books.
My wife has finished it. Meredith finished it.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that struck me really early on that I'm sure carries through the rest is that you are not making your own decisions all the way. Like the struggle is for you're trying to launch your independent life, right? I mean, the summer after your freshman year in college, you went and lived in this sort of intentional community, right?
Yeah.
Sort of a, you don't call it a commune, but those people seem to be very supportive of you sort of independently doing your own thing. And you make the decision that you want to go to Russia with your parents.
Ironically,
right?
Yes. Ironically, the Christian commune, which they don't call a commune, but that's what it was. They all lived in community. They actually gave their entire paychecks. All of the groups that were part of this church community gave their entire paychecks to the community. And they had a lot more independence than the church that I was coming out of.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
The part that kills me early on is you make a decision that at the end of the summer, mm-hmm. looking forward to leaving for Russia in January, that you want to go back to this town where the community is, you want to work, you want to save money, you want to live independently, you were going to take some classes, right? Yeah. And on the way, you'd gone to visit your parents, and then on your way back to spend the fall where you wanted to, on the way to the airport, your mom just says, oh, let's go talk to the pastor because I don't quite feel right about this. Yeah. And that turns out to you not going back at all to where you wanted to be, but the pastor sort of commanding you to stay there with your parents for the fall. And even working it so that you pay your brother's expenses to go to Russia. That killed me.
Yep. Yes. Yes.
Because the whole family went, right? Both of your brothers, you and your parents.
To be clear, I have three older brothers. My oldest brother, who was already married, did not come with us.
Okay.
But my two other brothers did come. So it was my mother, my father, my two older brothers, and I did all go together to start this school in Russia. Okay. And, to be clear, I had left, I was living in this commune with Quaker roots in Nanilchik, and,
thank you for pronouncing that.
Yes. living in this commune in Nanilchik, and I had gotten, my parents had already decided they were going to go start the School of Tomorrow in Russia, and I thought I wanted to go with them. I thought, hey, you know, this is a cool opportunity. I think I'll go too. And then I thought, well, why not stay here? I won't have to go find another job in Wasilla, which is where my parents lived and where I had grown up. I could just stay here. What's the difference? But that is not indeed what happened. And that was the beginning, that really the beginning of introducing the relationship that pastor had.
Right. Which is kind of authoritarian.
Yes, and that is one of the major threads of the story.
So the pastor continues to exercise some influence over the family's decisions and over your ability to make your own decisions throughout the story, right?
Yes. Yes, and it's interesting, too, that you talk about how my brother ended up using my job and my money as a resource to fund him going to Russia to pay for his way. This is another thing I'm trying to illustrate, is there are a lot of females, myself and some other females, to illustrate how the role of women in this type of culture.
Which is subservience, is, you know, what?
It's easy to use reductivist words to say, well, it was misogynistic and it was repressive, all of those things. Yeah, but we already know that. We all know that. We can use those words, and I'm sure there are university examinations happening right now with those as the multiple choice answers, right? But that's not what I'm trying to do with this book, and that was so important to me. I wanted to write a story that said, this is what it feels like. This is what it was. And so you can say, and everybody can raise their hand and get the right answers of, oh yeah, misogynistic, okay, you know, that's repressive and all of that. We know those words. We already know those words. Anyone who cares to know can go do that right now. But I wanted to draw a picture saying, feel this, taste this, get this sensation in your gut. Yeah. It was in mine.
And it works. I mean, you do that.
The story
that was really uncomfortable to read for me was, and it's funny because it's that same dynamic of authority, but there's no man involved. Mm-hmm. It's the story of being back at your church and going down to see your friend who's working in the nursery, who's volunteering in the nursery.
Oh, that part! Right? Yes!
And ending up hiding in the closet from her mother, who is the pastor's wife, right?
Yes.
And, you know, you're like 19, 20 years old, and you're hiding in the closet so as not to be discovered, helping out in the church nursery.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that experience, the way you talk about it, is a feeling of, it really jumps off the page. It's like, I'm an adult. Why am I behaving like a child? Well, it's because the structure here requires me to still be a child, right?
Yeah.
Like, it still treats me like a child.
So funny. It's so funny. That, I mean, yeah, that happened. That happened. I didn't remember that it happened. And so much of the time when I'm writing my life stories, this is not my only life story book, life story story that I've written. I've got short stories and more to come. But, like, yes, that actually happened. I hid in a closet for 2 hours.
And not just a closet. There was, like, basement. A crawl space under the closet that you hid in?
To be extra hidden. Yes, and
because
that's
what would
true.
Have happened if your friend's mom, the pastor's wife, would have discovered you in the nursery and not in church?
There was not a lot of space for grace. There
but
wasn't.
What
there
was
no
what's
space
the sin?
For grace.
What was the sin in being in the nursery and not in the worship service?
Oh, it wasn't that. Being in the nursery wasn't the problem.
Was that you had not asked permission?
Yes.
Okay.
What would happen? Well, the punishments of for infractions were as severe as they could be. As severe as, and I don't say that lightly, were as severe as the person in authority could get away with. And he got away with so much. Later on in the book, too, it talks about how there were times when my parents collaborated with this sort of punishment that they had completely bought into the authoritarian structure to say, oh yeah, of course, he has the right to do this. They did not defend me to say, hey, back off. So I didn't know how severe it could have been.
Did it seem really severe at the time, or does it seem now, like 20 years later, like you have got much more context and it looks, how does it look in retrospect compared to how it felt and looked right then and there?
It looks worse now. It looks far worse now.
That's what I was thinking. Because when you're in the middle of it, you just think, oh, this is how the world works.
I often wonder, so the pastor had these things that he did. I wonder, why would an adult voluntarily be part of this? None of the adults had to go. I had to. I didn't have my own car. And I wasn't permitted to be friends with people outside of the Christian faith. Well, I had a narrow band of people I could be friends with. Of course I could be friends with non-Christians for the sole purpose of converting them. But,
right, and when you wanted to go live in this commune the summer after your freshman year in college, your dad had to go with you for like a whole weekend.
Yes.
To check them out first and make sure they were okay.
And I mean, if you think about that, and it is the first chapter that is discussed, it kind of makes sense. It's like, well, of course you're not going to let your daughter go live somewhere without checking it out, but it unpacks to be more and more.
Right.
So I tried to make it a little bit accessible at the beginning. It's still pretty weird.
Right. Are your parents going to read this?
They already have. Actually, to be fair, my mom was a big supporter of writing this book the whole way through. She was one of my biggest editors. She read every single chapter several times all along the way and is really proud of me for having read it.
That's great.
However, now that they've read the whole thing, because it's different to read, you know, a PDF or an attachment or a this and a that, and then to get the whole thing in its highly polished form with a cover on it from start to finish, and it really hit them like a ton of bricks. It really put them right there. I think they finally saw what it was that I had been trying to say, you guys, that wasn't fair, for so long. They really got it. Of course, they're in a different place now. It's not my goal to sort of extract some sort of apology from them, because what good would that do?
You say they finally got it. How do you know that? Like, what was their reaction that indicated to you that this hit them in a specific way that it hadn't before?
They made a special point of conversing, like calling me and sending emails saying, this is a really good book. I'm sorry that was so hard for you then. I think we've learned a lot in the meantime. And my response is, hey, we're here now. Let's love each other now. Let's be here now. You know, you can't change the past, but it was pretty hard for them. But we're here. We are. We're family. We love each other. We find our way through.
And it's pretty clear to me that for you, writing this story, like all of your writing, is a exercise in. I don't know if the right word is discernment or reflection, or I mean that's what writing is fundamentally at some level, right? But you are, you're working through a story of, you know, a story of 2 years of your life that were a couple of decades ago, right? What kept you from writing this story before? Like, why? Where are you at in your life now that made it so that this could happen?
Yeah, so funny. Okay, it took me 12 years to write this book. So I didn't start writing the book until I finally graduated from college. I graduated from college what felt impossibly late. I felt like everyone else in the entire universe has graduated from college, and here I am taking night classes. So I graduated when I was 29. During that time, I had started a career in Silicon Valley doing technology work. Which was so exciting. I'm like, oh, I could just skip the part where you get a college degree and I could go straight to the part where you have a career. But I always felt sort of naked, oddly insufficient, because my education was so strange. It was in a Christian school and then homeschool, which is like, what? That doesn't even count, does it? I don't know. So I always felt like, well, I really need something else to prove that I'm educated. Prove, I guess, to myself, really. So I took night classes, and I did end up graduating with the English degree that I had always wanted, because I love books, I love reading. So when I graduated from college, San Jose State University, I finally felt like, oh, now I can write. I could have written it the whole time before, but somehow I gave myself permission, like, oh, I guess I know now. Ironically, I didn't take a single creative writing course during that time.
But you felt like you needed to have a degree in order to be able to write a book.
Total fallacy that I recognize now.
Huh. But why? What was that about? Like, I mean, I get it.
I think it's like, oh, now I. So then I also moved to Los Angeles, moved to Southern California right after that. The next job I got was in Southern California, and here I was in Southern California, like, oh, I'm going to move into a new town. And I'm like, gosh, I miss college. It was fun learning things. So I signed up for a class at UCLA Extension, memoir writing. After that class, I'm like, okay, I need to write this story. I'm like, I can't write the whole story. Maybe I could write a piece of it. I could just write one part of it. So I wrote the story. In my mind, I thought I can take some characters and write their story. So I wrote, I'm trying to remember the names that I changed the real people into. It was the story of Julie and Mike. I thought I could just start with their story. But as soon as I started writing their story, I'm like, well, I have to tell this part and I have to tell this part. And then I was off to the races. Mm-hmm. So that's how this started.
So as you wrote pieces of it, more pieces of it, like, needed to be written.
Yes. This has to be explained, and you know.
That's interesting, because I think what stops a lot of people from, like, writing a story, even an autobiographical one, is they feel like they've got to have the whole thing worked out before they start. But that's very much not what you did. You just started to write a particular piece of it, and getting that out there mm-hmm. brought the other pieces into focus.
Yeah, like, well, I obviously have to do this next part and then the next part. And I didn't write them in order. Mm. Man, this took so long. And I had... It was always just, okay, this is the next part, and this is the next part, and then, oh yeah, this is the next part. And I would take a look at my life and go, okay, I'm going to have a little patch of time here. And one of the times that I was pretty terrified... I had a child in the middle of writing this book, and I thought, I'll never finish this book. I'm going to have a baby. And I thought, well, I'll have all this maternity leave. There'll be free. There'll be free time. Yeah. So I actually printed out each chapter as I then understood it, stapled it together, and created it so that I thought while I was nursing, I could read that chapter and make like notes and edits to myself with one hand on each chapter. And I indeed did that. So I'm like, okay. And even if I knew like a chapter had to be written and hadn't been written yet, I wrote like a sentence. This is the part where I'm going to have to talk about this. And I could realize, okay, this is next. And so as I was making edits to myself, I could like circle one paragraph and go, this should be at the beginning or this should be the ending, or we don't need this at all, or don't forget to explain so-and-so here. So that was part of it. And then there were patches of time when I just went creatively dark because of other things in my life that were just, I'm like, I can't do this. And then I came back and I kept at it.
And you published other things in between, right? I mean,
yes.
The Alaskan Road Rules book. What's the other one here?
Parable of Miriam the Camel Driver and
The Pregnant Professional. Right. So yes. those all happened within the span of time that you had started to write The Russian American School of Tomorrow, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. Absolutely. So that was how I got the taste, The Parable of Miriam the Camel Driver. That's how I got the taste of what it was like to have a published book. So I was like, I'm going to practice doing this. And at that time, I didn't know if I was going to try to do the thing where you get an agent and everything else for The Russian American School of Tomorrow. As I was writing it, beneath me grew this independent self-publishing phenomenon, which has become extraordinary in the meantime.
So,
but I wrote it the whole way.
You found the self-publishing mechanism that has emerged to be totally legit and totally useful and a great tool.
For me, yes. Depends on your goal.
That's a good question. What was your goal in writing the story? Was it strictly personal, like I just need to tell the story and get it out there? Or are you writing this for a certain audience?
I'm writing for the audience that needs to hear it. I'm still not entirely certain who that audience is.
Have you heard from people?
Yes. I just sent a review copy to a young man in the UK who grew up in a School of Tomorrow school.
Really?
He has since become an atheist and is working on getting a PhD studying how bad the School of Tomorrow is.
Mm.
So he actually has like a blog on Pathos talking about School of Tomorrow survivor stories. And
did
so
you know about this blog before you wrote the book?
I discovered it during.
Wow.
I don't think it existed when I started, but you know, it was 12 years writing this book.
Yeah.
So I had found it since, and so I reached out to him. I said, hey, I wrote this book, and so he just got the review copy. He's pretty excited, and he said, I may want to interview you for my blog. I'm like, awesome. So obviously he has a set of people. There are certainly other places on the internet that talk about, there are Facebook groups that talk about, you know, survivor stories, like, oh my God. There were people that think it was great. I'm not saying that it was horrible all the way around, but...
Do these schools still exist?
Oh, yeah.
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 It sounds, I mean, the way you talk about it is almost like the way people talk about a cult when they got out of it. Has that comparison occurred to you?
Yes. Yeah. I've done a lot of research on cult theory, and that's some of the things that I actually used it to try to help my family in situations where they were sort of stuck.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That my book itself does not talk a lot about accelerated Christian education. It's actually the also known as School of Tomorrow. That's actually not one of the primary focuses, that type of culture. It could go that way. So the culture I describe is not necessarily the accelerated Christian education School of Tomorrow culture. It was just this type of culture, this type of power, pastoral.
Right. So that's not common to all the accelerated Christian education schools. That was just your particular situation.
Well.
Okay.
I don't know for sure.
I'm Rocky Suppinger, and this is the Yo Rocco podcast. This week I talked with Murphy Daly, the author of The Russian-American School of Tomorrow, a memoir about going to Russia at 18 with her family to start Christian schools. The thing that I was really interested in about this project for Murphy was that the independence of it seemed really critical for her. She is not one of those people who tried conventional publishing and then has resorted to self-publishing as a backup. She wants to self-publish. She does not want other voices or other hands, even editing the work that she is writing. And she has a very distinctive voice, and you can clearly hear that. But I wanted to find out a little bit more about what was behind that desire for independence. So in the second half of the conversation, we get into that a little bit, and we also get into her present relationship with the church. This was a very difficult experience in a church environment, and I wondered, how is it that she's still somebody who wants to be around churches? So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the second half of our conversation with Murphy Daly.
You said at the beginning of the conversation that it was really important to you that this story not be a type of story, right? That it was,
yes.
That you had, there's a certain prototype of this type of narrative out there. Mm-hmm. And it was really important to you that this really be your story, so much so that you didn't even know how it was going to end, really, like what it was about until you were completely done. So yeah. What's the biggest difference between that prototype and what you actually ended up with? Like, what were you trying to avoid in that narrative style that you identified?
One thing I was concerned about is if I used a traditional publisher, I could have gone like a secular publisher. I could have gone with a Christian publisher. It's very much a Christian book by the end, which I didn't know it was going to be until I finished. And I finished the first draft and I read the whole thing. I went, oh, I actually didn't think this was going to happen, but here it's happened. It's a Christian book. So, okay, that's what it is.
There are worse things.
Well, I wanted it to be true truth. If I had approached a publisher halfway through, the publisher would have told me, be this kind of story, because right. That's the story that sells. I don't care if it doesn't sell. That's okay. I don't need my money from my art.
So the goal, again, I asked you a second ago what the goal was. The goal is not, you're not trying to make this a livelihood. You're not trying to, you just said it doesn't, you don't care if it doesn't sell.
The work that I'm doing now to learn how to promote it and to market it is in service to the message, to the service of what it is. It is a powerful, powerful message that has not been written before. And there are a lot of people who will be benefited from it. So many different people. And I want to find those people in a really authentic way.
What I hear you saying is that the need to have the story be a certain kind of theme or to have a certain kind of point is what you really didn't want.
What I didn't want is if I went through a non-Christian publisher, it would have been very easy for it to be like twisted to be, oh, Christianity is bad, church is bad, pastors are bad.
Right, a tell-all confessional.
That's way too simple.
Right.
That is not the point of the story. And if I went to a Christian publisher, they could have been like, okay, well, you have to make sure not to say what you were really feeling or to have these doubts, or you'll have to make sure that it ends at this note and everybody in harmony. Maybe they wouldn't be that way. Right. I don't know. But I really didn't want anybody messing with the true truth of what happened in the story.
Okay. So for 12 years you worked on this book and had an outcome in mind, like what would be accomplished by getting it done? So now it's done. It's on Amazon. People are buying it. What is the outcome for you?
Phase one of the outcome was to exorcise the demon that I had to tell it. It's such a relief to have it be done. I'm like, oh, I have told this story. And it was transformative to me to work through it, to go through and write the whole thing out and go, yes, that happened. That was the true thing. I wrote a recent blog post about the feeling that every abuser says, don't tell anybody. Every abuser says, well, you just don't understand what happens. Like, no, I did. I was there. I understood it. And yes, I knew what was happening. So I told it all the way. all the way through, and people that have had similar stories that are also wrestling with it, I hope that this will be a starting point for them to realize realize their truth and their healing.
So you definitely got a goal.
Well, that goal was number one. And so the goal was me to be done with it and then to reach out and put it into the world so that it could do the work that it was... accomplish the work that was in mind when it was given to me to write.
Yeah. And you talked earlier about the muscle of promotion.
Yeah.
Right? That you're doing that now in a way that you weren't doing for your other books.
Right.
What are you doing?
When I wrote the parable of Miriam the camel driver and I told people about it, people did buy it. Some people bought it and some people didn't. And it hurt my feelings that these people didn't read my book. But it's just a little book. You could read the book. It wasn't that expensive. You could go buy it. And so I felt like people should want it, but they didn't necessarily. So I was more thin-skinned about it with the other books. And with the book of... with this latest book, The Russian-American School of Tomorrow, I realized that the book is bigger than me, and so I do need to go down and find people, say, hey, you're going to want to read this book, not just because I'm awesome, but because the book is awesome. You're really going to want this. And so I've taken sort of my ego aside and am doing this work of learning about it and talking about it in service to the book and what it has been.
What are the tools that you're finding useful to do that?
I'm using Twitter a lot. I've actually started conversations with people. I look online and find people who have had, like they talk about their experiences, talk about if they've been to the school tomorrow, if they have, you know, people, when they're on Twitter, they'll like link to their blogs and whatever. I found some people that were raised in Christian schools and other things. And I actually start conversations with them. Yeah, wouldn't it be great if it went viral? Well, okay, that might happen. But until then, I'm going to go find person by person and say, hey, I think you'd like this book. But I don't just start out with that. I say, hey, I see that you've done this. Wow, that was an interesting experience. And they'll talk about it, and we have a little conversation. Then I say, I think you'd like to read my book. And I've sold a couple that way.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the first people that I did sell it to wrote me a review. She goes, I really like your book. I said, I would really like it if you wrote a review. She goes, okay. She did it right then.
Yeah.
So I've got 5 reviews on Amazon. And reviews, honestly, of course reviews are important, because if I see a book and I don't know what it's about, I look at the reviews. If it's got no reviews, I'm like, obviously it can't be that great of a book. Because, you know, you want to know if somebody else liked it.
Right.
So the people that are reviewing are doing me a really great favor. And
you're
so
clearly reading the reviews.
Well, maybe not daily.
But that's isn't that one school of thought for writing or for any artist is don't read the reviews. Or
after you get so popular that you get haters, yeah, I suppose. I'm just taking all the love I can get.
And it's all been love, all the
reviews.
Yeah,
they're all 5 reviews are 5 stars right
now.
That's
terrific.
So it's been great.
So you're actually inserting the book into conversations, is what it seems to me. Like, you're going out looking for places where people are having this conversation about these schools and maybe similar situations, and inserting the book as a useful contribution to that conversation, not simply a means of selling it. But
you know, what happened after, and if I can bear to do it, there might be a sequel, because what happened after the events in the book is actually more dramatic than what happened during the events of the book. Anyway, when that happened, when I was 21 and had returned to America, so much of what I came back to was like, what just happened? What just happened? What was all that? I mean, my entire life, the last 5 years, the last 3 years, what was that? And that's when I started researching cults, that's when I started researching spiritual abuse, of which there was very little information at the time in 93. But that huge question of what just happened here, I think, was in the mind of a lot of people who experience unfortunate church relationships, and probably the experience of what happened in Christian schools and what happened in accelerated Christian education. They're like, what was that? Why did everyone think that was an awesome idea? What was that? Who thought it was a great idea to do that?
And did you come up with some answers?
I came up with a clear expression of my experience.
Okay.
And I think that I came up with an expression that is understandable and meaningful, deeply meaningful. So when people read the book, I think they get it. People, when they read the book, they don't go, oh, now I understand, and I can now write a curriculum about it. The book is way more complicated than that. I don't treat it lightly, because it shouldn't be treated lightly. All of these things that caused these events to happen. I mean, Johnny, the guy that's studying the School of Tomorrow in the UK, he and I had a quick discussion about through email about how the School of Tomorrow was launched because it was or the Christian school movement in general was launched as a part of resisting desegregation in America. Mm. It was like the exact time that the Supreme Court said you cannot have segregated schools anymore. Well, now we got a whole bunch of Christian schools that can be private, and
right,
we don't have to cooperate with this mandate that we don't want to cooperate with. We'll just flout that federal government. Well, that's not pretty, but it wasn't necessarily the reason for every school to get started, but that's complicated. That's far outside the scope of my book, but that's just an example of how it's not one thing, but it often has trails of ugliness throughout it.
So you said you might write a sequel that explores some of those other things, but that doesn't sound to me like the aim of writing this one, right? You were not out to get someone or out to, in writing this book, you were trying to tell your story honestly,
yeah,
for yourself as well as for people who've had similar experiences. You're not out to, this is not like investigative journalism. You're not out to...
No.
But those other pieces of what follows after and understanding the larger movement that you were caught up in,
oh,
may, I mean, that sounds a little bit more like that, like more actual, you know, research and...
That would not be what the sequel of the story would
be. That's not the what you would want to write.
That's not what I would be writing.
What parts of that interest you that you might want to write about?
To talk about the geopolitical forces underway that influence my personal experience. You can't separate a person's daily life from what is happening in history at that precise moment in the time-space continuum.
Right, you showed up in Russia in 1991.
Right, and there are a lot of things that I didn't, that I said as subtly as I could. I mentioned that at the library, I found a lot of English language books in the Russian library. Well, a lot, a couple shelves worth. It was a lot to me. And almost all of the writers in the English language section of the Russian libraries were writers that had been blacklisted during the McCarthyism era.
Hmm.
That's part of the time-space continuum that we're part of. So I'm like, oh, I never heard of this book. This is actually a really good book. And it turns out there was a reason it was there. And my mom sort of lightly mentions it. I also, at the same time when I was in Russia, somebody mentions, oh, you know, aren't you worried about all the race riots that are happening in America right now?
And I said, in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yes.
The Rodney King riots.
That's when the LA riots were happening, and I didn't know that. I thought, that's not what's happening in America. We don't do that anymore. Well, it turns out it was happening, but it wasn't clear to me. So these are like simple things. So to say that, the communism that happened, and I talk about, even in the Alaskan, the first part of the book, I talk about my boyfriend, Alex, who was a refugee from communism. I talk about his experience and how that was pretty horrifying, that he had to, like, run to get away from the country. He didn't want to live there anymore, but he wasn't free at all. And he had, like, people requiring him to have propaganda posters so that he looked like he was following the party line. Well, wasn't that a lot like what was happening in my church, too? But to say that Russia, communist Russia, had that kind of bad experience, I also mentioned some things that were happening in America, too, that were part of the geopolitical landscape that weren't awesome either, because we're all in there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about these things, it influences the writing because it reminds me what to say we are all in this soup. We are all in this soup. And just because I was in an impossibly remote town in the far Asian, far eastern side of the Soviet Union, and I was in a little tiny town in Alaska, we're all connected. It's all us. And so I'm telling my story, but I'm not telling a journalism story. If you want that, go find somebody else. And even the journalists, when they tell their journalistic research stories, are not without their biases.
Here's the thing that is really interesting to me, and it's always been really interesting to me about your story, because we've known each other for 2-3 years, right?
Yes, we have.
2 or 3 years. And from the time that you started to come to church here, you're very, like, conversant in this story. Not the whole thing, but I knew I knew this piece about going to Russia and the Christian schools, and you know, early on in our conversations had referred to this as, like, a really negative thing. And I remember thinking, how is it that this person still wants to be around churches?
Oh.
There must have been a time, maybe this is later on in the book that I haven't got to, but there must have been, like, a season of just not wanting anything to do with Christianity or religion at all, or church. Was there?
No. This is the part where I'm tearing up for
That's right.
our audio audience.
You don't have
God
to answer
is
that.
Faithful. God is faithful. And although... one of the really positive aspects of cults is how very immersive a community they are. So, being that I was in Christian schools and homeschool, they were everything. Church was everything. I wasn't allowed to be friends with my neighbors, so I had to be part of the church. Well, the church kind of filled that up, and so I wanted the community, and there was definitely sort of, what's the right word, church xenophobia. So fear of other people not part of the church, so I couldn't be sure that other people weren't out to get me in some way, even though the church said that they were out to get me, and I didn't believe that the church was right, but I couldn't be sure, so I'm like, yeah.
Other people, like non-Christians, you mean?
Or even not the right sort of Christians.
<Let's> Presbyterians.
yeah. So I thought that there would be the right sort of group somewhere, and I wanted it, and so I kept trying for it. Mm. Towards the end of the book, there is a reconciliation, spoiler alert, with God. So I'm like, well, I know that particular church I was raised in isn't the right sort, but there's got to be one somewhere. And so I was going to keep trying. And you can't give up. I didn't feel like I could give up.
I mean, as a parent now, with, you know, you have a 6-year-old child in a church environment.
Yes.
You must be highly sensitive to like exercises of authority around children in churches or around youth in churches.
No, exercises of authority as a whole is I'm very sensitive to that. Yes.
How does that, like, show up?
Okay, a specific example. When I first started coming here, you asked me if I would do a Sunday school class. And I said, okay, all right. And it was not, I think it was for, I don't know, a month or 2 month period. And very early on, someone asked me, hey, you want to go do a thing on Sunday? And I thought, I can't, I have a Sunday school class. And I went, wait a minute, I shouldn't change my other friendships for the church. And so I'm like, okay, I'm just going to say, I can't do it that Sunday. Just sort of almost as a, that fleece. You're like, you better think this is okay, and then I'll know if you're okay.
The Gideon story.
Yeah, the Gideon, the Gideon thing. And it was fine. You're like, oh yeah, sometimes you can't make it. And I'm like, okay, all right, I can do this. I can not be there on one Sunday, and it's okay. And so that was a specific example. I was like testing, like, is this, you know?
Yeah. Like, if I had freaked out, I'd be like, no, you have to be here.
Yeah, that would have been, so, you know, test the water a little bit.
Well, here's what's really interesting to me about that, is that from the standpoint of a congregation, you know, so many of the things that people in churches can do with their time on Sunday other than come to church, mm-hmm. if they have kids, you know, soccer mm-hmm. and all, or even if they don't, so many of those other things seem to have higher expectations on people's participation than church does. And I've heard people in church conversations suggest maybe we just need to have higher expectations and say, no, you can't miss. You have to be here. This has to be a priority. But it occurs to me that if that had been the climate, you would have been like, nope.
It would have been a problem.
Yeah. So there is something valuable about that. Like, whenever you're here, we're glad you're here, no matter what obligations you may have met or not met beforehand.
To split the hair, if it had been, hey, you are an important person, you have valuable skills and talents to add to the to here, if it had been like, you will be missed, your contribution is important to us, and we'd really like to have you, is a different tone than God will punish you
okay.
if you don't show up. So tone does matter.
Sure.
You know, and
not just tone. That's a very different that's a very different thing to even say
yeah.
or to believe, right?
Yeah. Church should be a draw. You should come there because you get something out of it. Mm-hmm. And I've always felt like I get something out of what the church is supposed to be, whether any particular church that I'm in at that moment is what it's supposed to be. Is always a question, and that's true of every individual as well. But church is supposed to be something that you really get something out of. If the benefit of being at church is a benefit, then people are hungry to come back. Mm-hmm. So the benefit of going to soccer is being able to play, and the benefit of whatever else anybody is choosing to do on a Sunday morning or many all of the other time slots that church activities happen in are a perceived benefit. People get their goodies out of that. So church should also be that way too. So to say, well, you should be here, you're pushing a string. If people want to be there and they're getting the good juice out of it, they'll come.
Yeah. But what used to work as the sort of default mode of religiosity for churches like this one is was obligation, that you know, you should be there, you ought to be in church, and even now...
Are you sure that's what it was?
I think it still is that way in some quarters. I mean, I see people who have not been in church for several weeks, and I see them at the grocery store, and the first thing they do is apologize for having not been in church enough. And I didn't ask them to do that. I'm not...
Well, okay, so one of the reasons I come to church is because it's an opportunity to do what I do. I've heard it said before that a beaver will build a dam. If you put a beaver on top of a skyscraper, they'll start building a dam. That's what they do. So some of the things that I do is I do self-expression. I do encouraging of people. So a church is a place that I can do that. And it's a place where I can do it in the way that I want to do it, talking about things like love and kindness and good deeds. And it's not necessarily, other places won't necessarily have that same emphasis. So here's a place where I can do that. And I'm like, okay, well, I want to be here. I want to organize a fun night of self-expression. I want to have a chance to give self-expression to my thoughts, which Lord knows I do on my blog and in my books, and I can also do it in a Sunday school class. Yeah. I can teach a Sunday school class or even respond actively in a Sunday school class. So that's why I come. I get to do that thing that I do. So being of service is not only for the people who are receiving the services, of the people who are able to do what they do. It's the beaver that's building the dam. So all of us are some kind of beaver.
Yeah. It's kind of inspiring to hear you talk about all of this as like a unified whole. Like, you know, you're self-publishing these books and telling these stories and being part of a church community. It's, yeah. I mean, this is what you do. Mm-hmm. It's not, I think for many people, maybe church is a like a fragment of their life and experience, and that's true of professionals in the church as well, right? Like, it's the job, and then the rest of the life is cordoned out in other ways. Like, even this, for me, like doing a podcast, we're in my office at the church, you're a member of my church, this is the closest to my church job this podcast has ever come, but it's always been an expression of what I do, right? And I wonder about like creativity and doing creative work in an era when all the tools you need to do it are just there, right? I mean, you had all the tools you needed to write and to publish, and you didn't have to wait for someone to give you access to these things.
No.
I wonder if doing creative work in this day and age really demands it be part of who you really are and what it is you want to do wherever you're at and with whatever job you may have at the moment. I mean, you're a professional person. You have a job in information technology. You're a project manager.
Yes.
That's like the 180 degrees in my mind away from the writer of books like this.
Other people may see it as something different, but that's because they're not living it.
Do you talk about these books at your job?
Yes, these four are on display right now.
Really?
Yes. This job, previous jobs I have not, but this one, I'm like, it's time for me to live out loud. It's time for me not to, oh my gosh, they are so personal. The Russian-American School of Tomorrow is so embarrassing. But I put it out there, it's time to live it and trust the world to, you know, to come out of the closet.
have any of your coworkers read the book?
I don't know. Probably not.
You're not like putting it in front of them.
I haven't been at this particular job very long.
Right.
I'm not.
It's a couple of weeks on this one.
Well, one of them I did, but anyway.
Okay.
you know, they might, and if they do, I'll say, yeah, that was me, and that was me a long time ago. Isn't it embarrassing to think about what you were like when you were 18?
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Finally, oh my gosh, when I first came to California, and I kind of said, oh yeah, I was in Russia and I was homeschooled, I got some negative reactions from people. And I'm like, obviously this is something I should never talk about again.
Hmm.
Hide it. Back to the secrecy thing.
In what quarters were these people who reacted negatively to it?
Just, they weren't church people. They were just friends from work.
Huh.
And I was, you know, you when you're meeting new friends and you're getting to know them, you're like, well, you know, what movies did you watch? Whatever. I mean, all that. I'm like, well, I wasn't allowed to watch movies. What? Like,
that conversation gets like, strange very quickly.
Yeah. So it's like, so today, let's talk about today, or let's talk about you. Let's talk about you. That's actually something I learned in Russia. When I was trying to learn the Russian language and I would go to someone's house for tea, which was the only thing you could do because there were no entertainments. So I'd go to someone's house to visit. And they did not speak English very well, and I could speak Russian to them, and I wanted to get better at Russian. Everything went far more smoothly if I were the one talking.
Mm.
If I were the one talking, because I would know what I was saying, and I could understand my own Russian, whereas I might not be able to understand theirs. So if I could control the conversation to the part where I knew what was happening, then you know, I could steer the conversations. I'm like, so I went on a walk today and I bought bread that I learned in Russia. So when I came, you know, and tried to live in the real world in the lower 48 of California, I could control my conversation by, what do you like? Not going to the places that were just going to be pitfalls. And after a time, I found that, you know, those first couple people that had negative reactions were, like, not friends I wanted to keep.
Right.
Because they were kind of mean to me. And so I found other people that were interested in who I was and my experience and were, you know, kind, etc. But it took me a while to arrive at that sort of trust.
Right. It's such a unique story, but it has this resonance with lots of different kinds of people who even though they may not have lived a the exact same kind of thing, you know, they've experienced something similar, or there are echoes of their own story in the story that you're telling, and the mm-hmm. fact that you're telling it in a public way, obviously publishing it yourself,
yes.
Is enabling other people to kind of hear echoes of their own story in it. I mean, that's part of the value in doing it.
Yeah, not only to hear echoes of their own story. I would hope that every single person could understand, oh, that's what it feels like when you're, you know, young and dumb and trying to live on your own for the first time. That's pretty universal in America. And maybe across the world, the first time you're trying to live on your own is somewhat universal. And that would be a beginning towards understanding the non-universal things, so that there's a point of overlap to talk about the things that are really hard to talk about with the people who have experienced them and the people who would like to befriend and support the people who haven't experienced them but would like to support the people who have.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so hard to write. I talk about it. I ground up my soul for 10 years and put it in the book, like just ground soul. I'm like, okay, all right, so exhausting. Now it's done.
Whew. Yeah. You used the term embarrassing a second ago, right? Mm. I mean, you're writing about your embarrassing self at 21.
19
through 21, right?
18 through 19.
Okay.
It's only 1 year in the book.
Okay. But, I mean, we all have a 18 or 19-year-old self that did things that we're embarrassed by now.
I've come to terms with that truth.
Clearly.
Now.
I was going to say, we don't all write about it publicly. We don't all publish stories about it. But that's another thing that a lot of the people that I'm talking to on this podcast who are doing this kind of work are confronting, is their own sort of embarrassing failings, their own just kind of like the messiness of being a human being in the world and looking goofy and doing things incorrectly, that there is a default for a lot of them, a default public setting on life. And if I'm going to fail and I'm going to look dumb, I'm just going to do it publicly. There's not going to be a practice run. I'm going to get better by doing this publicly.
Before I started writing The Russian American School Tomorrow, I started a blog. So that was the put it out there, the world can see it. I've had a blog for 13 years.
This is the Wonder Blog.
The Wonder Blog.
So wonderblog.com, right?
No, unfortunately, no.
I don't know the actual address because I get it in the email.
Yeah. You get weekly episodes.
I get the Weekly Wonder.
The Weekly Wonder, which is my blog is www.writtenbymurphy.com.
Right.
And there's a blog on that page. And I have, you know, there's tons of content on there. I write at least weekly, often more. And I send out a weekly newsletter. Because after Facebook opened up, it turns out that hardly anybody was visiting my blog anymore. Because I guess everyone that would have visited it before decided they were getting enough of me by being friends with me on Facebook. And I'm like, well, that's a bummer.
So the way to get your blog post read now is people have to share them on Facebook.
I tend to share them, But
well, I do all mine,
but,
too.
But the point of putting it out there and being messy, I had this blog sandbox for years, and I had gotten used to just saying, put it out there, just be that, and if people don't like it, most of the time people just don't care. They really don't care. And so, you know, I put it out there and people could care. Unfortunately, you have a more public persona because you're a pastor, so you're already a leader of a church, so that's a little scarier for you, I imagine. But as an individual citizen, I could just put anything I wanted out there. And so I got to practice doing that.
That's not true. You have a family. There are people that you have to, like, that you owe things to that you can't, like, just be responsible publicly in the way that you present yourself.
Well, true, but, you know, so I developed a way to be careful about that, and I talk about that on my blog, too, but, so the putting it out there publicly, I got to practice doing that with my first three published books. I got to figure out what that was about, knowing that it would lead towards the eventual publishment of the magnum opus of the Russian-American School of Tomorrow, which I was working on the whole time. I got to practice trying it out and seeing what it was about. And so, you know, I didn't take the same care with my first book, The Parable of Miriam the Camel Driver. I didn't take that same care. And but with the Russian-American School of Tomorrow, I knew this. I had put so much work into it. I was not going to put it out until it was fabulous. Mm. So I found, you know, and I also knew that I didn't want an editor changing the tone of the book. But even after I got through the first draft, I combed through it, and I found beta readers to give me feedback, and I combed through it carefully, and I found this tool online called Pro Writing Aid, and I could run each chapter through it, and it would give me suggestions like, okay, this particular sentence is longer than all the other sentences, and this one has passive voice, and you use exclamation points too much, and you shouldn't use the word very, like, oh, and all these other things. And they had a lot of really, I mean, it was a computer telling me this, but this computer had rules like, hey, you're using this one word more frequently than you should. And I could think about, oh, what do I mean with that word? And I could make the decision, and I combed through every single chapter carefully, polishing it as best I could until it was really beautiful. And I think I wanted my writing to be as good as I could possibly make it. And so all of the practicing that I did and the messy things that I did 13 years on the blog and the other things that I'd written, I'm like, this book I really polished, and I am really proud of it. I think that the writing is excellent, and I did everything I could to make it as good as possible.
It is. I mean, it's really compelling reading.
Thank you.
And it's great to see. I mean, it's great to see somebody who produced something like this feel so happy in the end result, right?
Yeah.
I think artistically, a lot of people I talk to feel like they have to be driven by this tortured sense of it's never good enough. You don't feel that way about this book. You feel like it's really good, and you're proud of it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, I also got to learn. Thank you. I got to learn that because I tried it with The Parable of Miriam the Camel Driver. I'm like, oh, this is the wrong format. Oh, I did this misspelling. And I should, full disclosure, me and my husband are a team working on this. My husband has also published two books himself. He has written and published two of his own books. He's working on a third one. We have, we started a publishing company. We've published other people's books. And so we worked on the whole part of what it takes to go from beginning to end to publish a book with other people. So we learned what is a baseline standard of, like, reasonable expectations. So if I find, and I have found an error or two within the Russian-American School of Tomorrow, like, oh, that formatting wasn't what I wanted, oops, or that's going to be a typo or a wrong whatever, and I can sort of forgive myself for that. And I think the readers will, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I can know that's okay. I don't have to get all verklempt about it, get all, like, tied up about it. I can let it go because I practiced it before. Being a self-published independent author means it is all on me. I had to work really hard to get this right. I did the layout for everything. I had to make sure that the page numbers were right. I had to make sure that the fonts were the pretty way I wanted them to be. I had to go hire a photographer to get the headshot of me on the back. I had to write the back cover. I used two different cover designers, and the first one was terrible, and the second one was awesome. I did all of the work, which, that was a big pain to do all that, but I did it. And that's the difficult side of doing it all yourself. And yet, it was worth it to me because I did not want to be part of the powers that be. The powers that be were the powers that created Pastor in the book. And if I thought that the powers that be should be in power, I could go collaborate with them and get an advance.
You just tweeted something like that a couple hours ago.
I was preparing for this meeting, this podcast, and like, if you want the powers that be to be in power, then great, collaborate. But if you want something different, then take the power for yourself, like Seth Godin says. It is your turn, and do it. So I have the power, but I have the power to do all these things. They are there. The internet, which I got on super, super, super early, 1990, I got on the internet before it was the World Wide Web, but I was experiencing all of what this could do, and so I knew early on that this was all possible, but it was all possible only if I did the work, if I found out all the things that it would take, if I learned how to do things like buy an ISBN. So, to go back to this, my husband collaborated very much with me to make this possible, and he is my crack research staff. Mm-hmm. He found out all the ways that it made the best financial sense, and he did all kinds of research to help make this possible. So to say that I'm an independent author, I am, with the help of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I am with the help of all the people that created the internet, yes.
Right.
And I am with the people that put themselves on the line, like the people that did the beautiful cover that I'm very happy with.
It's a great cover.
Are a brand new, tiny little cover startup.
Is that you?
No, it's not. It's
it looks, I mean, that silhouette, like I assumed it was you. It's not a silhouette. It's a picture of somebody from the back, but I thought it was you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's meant, but it's non-distinguishing. It's just a woman in a coat. So
if the jacket you're wearing right now had a hood on it, it would be that jacket.
Yeah, unfortunately, the jacket that I wore in Russia was a lot uglier. but the point is, actually, because I talked to the cover designers and I said, hey, that street that you have chosen as a photo is far more attractive than the actual town. And they said, well, we can't have it. We need the book cover to be attractive a little bit.
Right.
No, it needs to be appealing. You got a point. So,
yeah, it's nice.
So that's.
But the people who are working with you now, yes, are people who are choosing to work with you.
Yeah.
Right?
And there are people that understand that they don't get to boss me.
Right. They're not the boss of you.
Yeah. And also I get to pay them and I get to select, but it's up to me, you know, to find the right people and to do the work and find the tools. And if I pick the wrong one, then I have to try again.
Yeah.
And all that. And the amount of versions of this book that are still on my computer is staggering. Like,
So this is very much a trajectory for you that you're on with the work that you're doing, the writing, and just sort of the way that you're approaching life is, you get to call the shots. It's your turn. And
yes. Because that is the truth of our Christian life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It is up to each individual to look at what our choices are and what we're called to do. You talked a little bit about I see my whole life and the work that I do professionally, the work that I do writing, as a seamless whole. That's true of everyone, however external people see it. We also have to make our choices, and we can't separate out one thing from another and say, oh, well, this is this and that's that, and this is okay to give up my power and authority in this area. God created us in His own image, and God's major characteristic is creation. We are all creative people. We all have creative power in each of us, whatever form it expresses itself, whether it be in making dinner or making a book or making a painting or music or whatever it is, or being an incredibly great accountant. All of these things are creative powers in each of us, and we should not give up that creative force to anybody else. It is always our responsibility to do the right thing with it and to be the best that we can be. There shouldn't be something between us and our expression. There shouldn't be somebody saying, you're not allowed to, or you can only do it if.
Right.
So to the point that someone will collaborate with you in your creative vision, awesome, collaborate with them. And if you find a collaborator in the traditional publishers or traditional powers that be, okay. But that is never an obligation. Mm. You always have the right to take your own power.
Right.
And not only do you have the right, you have the responsibility, because that's why you were put here, and that's why God gave you that creative force.
I think that's a great note to end on.
Okay.
Thank you for the book, for the work that you're doing, for being part of this community, and for being willing to talk to me and be a part of this creative thing that I'm trying to do. And for listening to it, I think you're my most devoted listener.
Probably not, but I'm glad that you're doing it.
You're the only person who tweets about your listening to the podcast, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank
so,
you.
All right, thanks.
Many thanks again to Murphy Daly for her time and her honesty on the podcast this week. Really appreciate it. You can buy The Russian American School tomorrow on Amazon, or you can click the link on the Yo Rocco podcast page at YoRocco.com to buy it as well. Thanks also to Landon Witsit, a.k.a. Go to Sleep John Darling, who wrote the cool theme music that you've been enjoying, and to Brian Ellison, who recorded the introduction. You can subscribe to the Yo Rocco podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or whatever you listen to podcasts with, or you can listen to all 10 episodes of the podcast that we've done at YoRocco.com. So until next time, I'm Rocky, and this has been the Yo Rocco podcast.